The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The football never ends, and now it's the Champions League, Europa League mega end of season shootout. How do we feel about the straight knockout, and who's going to win the big one? No Bale in the Real Madrid squad. Is it time to call time on whether it's time to call time on his future? The Europa League is almost at the stage when people get interested. United and Inter are through, while there's a wild final minute in Donetsk, and Rangers and Wolves give it a go tonight. Also, make 55 people redundant while trying to sign a 31-year-old winger on 100 grand a week isn't a good look. Have Arsenal got a leg to stand on? Also, the armpit offside is the solution just to take the lines off the telly? Then none of us will know the truth. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, it's you again.
Hello, Max. How are you?
Yeah, really good, thank you. Lars Sivertsen, hello.
Hi, Max.
How are you?
I'm beside myself with excitement.
Because?
It's the Europa League. We're going to get a Norwegian sort of coaching duel in the quarterfinals of the Europa League. You know, Solbakken versus Solskjaer. There's the real clash of the Norwegian titans. It's very good.
I'm excited. And that's what everyone is talking about, isn't it?
I think it is. Yeah. And if they're not, they're fools who need to be re-educated. And that's what we're here for.
From the Racing Post, it is everyone's favourite butter lover, Mark Langdon. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Max. It's going well. That tale. It reached the primary school teacher, my son, who my son came home completely bamboozled, telling a story from Mr. Moyes, not that one, but a different Mr. Moyes. And he didn't have a clue what was going on. My son, he just said, "You like butter, Dad?" And I was like, "Yeah, you know that, you know. Tuck in yourself some," but it was a quite a bizarre sort of way to go viral, I think.
Absolutely. Well, I mean,
is that not some sort of breach of ethics, your teacher divulging information he's heard on a podcast to your son? You know, for all he knows, you might be a secret butter fetishist who wants to keep your sordid dairy secret from your son.
To be honest, if that's the biggest secret that gets out, I'm happy enough with that, Barry.
Are there more?
We'll wheedle them out of them before the end of this podcast.
Right, for those of you who get too bored before the end of the podcast and don't listen to all of it, at the end of the last time Mark was on, we asked if he had eaten any vegetables in lockdown, and he said sweet corn, but only because he hides the sweet corn in the butter. And actually, people were more interested in that than any of the football discussion I think we've had in the last 2 years. And I don't know what that says about Football Weekly, either about the panellists or the audience. But we're all in this together. As somebody tweeted, I'd happily listen to The Guardian Butter Weekly with Mark Langdon. What's your favourite butter, etc. Maybe we'll get onto that at the end of the pod. Let's start then with the...
Do you think if... we did have the Butter Weekly, that within a few weeks there would be the totally equivalent I Can't Believe It's Not Butter Weekly with James Richardson.
And then obviously a 30,000-word Athletic article on how Lurpak spreadable is spreadable, even straight from the fridge. Elliot writes, should all the European teams left in the two tournaments just have to select two players each and play a quick tournament of World Cup doubles and just to get it over and done with? Lars, what do you
no.
think? I actually feel quite excited about these little tournaments that are about to happen.
Yeah, me too. I do think... I don't want it to be a permanent shift, but for now the one-off game format is quite enticing, isn't it? It adds a little bit of spice to the mixture. If we were going to do something wonky, I would want it to be like that old advert. I guess it was Nike, probably, where they all went to a ship and played cage football with sort of Eric Cantona looking at them. That would be my preferred sort of format change. But we're not going to do that. So no, it's good. It's great that it's back. I really enjoyed it last night.
Barry, what do you think? I feel this is, and I I actually wouldn't mind this being how it was always done. I don't need two legs. I quite like one leg. I quite like the idea of making it like a sort of World Cup for club teams without wanting to sound like I'm applying for a job at FIFA. But I'm really looking forward to this.
No, I'm looking forward to it too. It's like having a little summer World Cup or Euros, but without the not as exciting bits. I'm not going to say the group stages are boring, but I'm wholeheartedly in favour of it and really looking forward to it. And I would also be in favour of one-legged games. I mean, it's probably not hugely fair, but I think I'd prefer it.
So Friday night then, Manchester City play Real Madrid. Man City are 2-1 up from the first leg. The big story is Zidane leaving Gareth Bale out of the entire squad, not just out of the starting lineup. He hadn't featured in their last seven games. Should I be surprised about that, Mark?
Probably not anymore. I mean, I think the fact that he saw so little football after lockdown, when the reports coming out of Madrid, and certainly from Bale's point of view, was that he came back in some of his best shape that he'd been at. You know, for some years he was fully fit, but there'd just become this episode where he would be seen kind of pretending to be asleep and messing around with his mask at the end, of matches, rather than being involved. And I think that this is probably just the ultimate power play, really, from Zinedine Zidane in trying to get Gareth Bale, almost shaming him, I suppose, into leaving and forcing him to depart. But of course, he was happy to leave sort of this time last year, wasn't he, to China? And then Real Madrid decided right at the last moment that they wanted money from the transfer. Otherwise, he would have gone. So I think that Real Madrid it's up to Real Madrid, I think, to do an Alexis Sanchez style, just give him away type deal. Because if I'm Gareth Bale, being treated like that isn't really going to make me want to take a pay cut to leave, I don't think.
Lars, is it, in a footballing sense, a sensible decision of Zidane to leave Gareth Bale completely out of the squad?
I mean, he hasn't been that great when he's played. Now, you could argue that that's because he's been marginalised to the extent that he has. I think after a season when they won the league, where they've only conceded 25 goals in 38 games, and especially since they were so relentless after restart, Zidane has kind of earned the right to make those decisions, I think. I find this is an odd situation where I kind of sympathise with everyone. You want to rage at someone when you have a standoff like this. This person, this is a disgrace. Oh, that is really bad. I feel like I kind of understand everyone's point of view here. You can say that Gareth Bale, if he was willing to take a substantial wage cut, there'd be plenty of clubs he could go to and who would pay for him. But then again, he's like 31 now and has a history of injuries. And why would he give away loads of money to move somewhere else if he doesn't want to? It's not really something they can expect him. No one forced Real Madrid to give him that contract. They should pay him what he's owed. At the same time, from Real Madrid's perspective, they have a guy there who's on, I think he's on roughly twice the money Mesut Ozil is on. Like, we talk about Mesut Ozil's contract a lot, but Bale is on about twice that. You can understand why they want to move him on if the coach, who's doing quite well, who they quite like, absolutely doesn't want him around the team. So it's kind of a really sort of, the situation is like it's a sort of Gordian knot that doesn't sort of make sense. And I kind of sympathise with everyone's point of view, so I don't have anyone to rage against.
Barry, when it's good to seek advice from people in similar positions to you about life decisions, there aren't that many people Gareth Bale can go to say, should I take a £500,000 a week pay cut to earn £100 a week? And it's very easy for us to say that's what you should do, because it's unlikely that any of us will face being in that position. I'm certainly not in that position at the moment. But what should he do?
Yeah, Gareth Bale has achieved a lot in football. He obviously has other interests, specifically golf. He loves playing golf. He's obsessed with golf. He may just be content to sit out his contract. If I was in his position, I think I would just like to play football, because your career is only so long. He's got plenty of years left in him, you would imagine, injuries permitting. And I'm guessing he's not short of a bob or two. But I personally would not want to work for and have to go into an office every day where I knew I wasn't wanted.
Well, this is awkward. Sorry, that was an open goal, wasn't it? Let's talk about the game. Sergio Ramos is banned. I saw Real Madrid's market 25-1 to win the tournament, and a lot of that is because they're 2-1 down to City in this game. Would have a tricky run anyway, but that seems incredibly long odds for the team that won La Liga.
Yeah, I mean, I think purely on a maths point of view, then it is about right, because they're going to need to score at least twice at the Etihad, then probably beat Juventus, then possibly beat Bayern Munich just to reach the final. But I feel like they've got a fair enough chance in terms of that kind of outsiders. You are in a difficult position, obviously, but Real Madrid are playing a lot better now than they were when that first leg came around. Eden Hazard is back fit again, which I think obviously is important for them, with him and Benzema up front. They've got a very experienced midfield with Casemiro, Toni Kroos, who didn't play in the first leg, and also Luka Modric. So they've definitely got the players to hurt Man City and play on any nerves that come from the fact that City have messed up a couple of these situations before. And, you know, if they score first Real Madrid, and even though there's no crowd there, I do feel like City will get edgy because, you know, they have blown it. I mean, that one against Tottenham last year, really, you know, that they should never have got themselves into that position where they got knocked out. Real Madrid are a lot sort of stronger all over the pitch than what you would say Tottenham are. So it's definitely possible for Real Madrid to cause the upset. But what you were saying about Sergio Ramos being out, I think that is important. Such an influential player for them. And I think there is a big drop off between Militao and Ramos in terms of that sort of second centre back alongside Varane. So I expect City to go through, but I can see it being a nervy 90 minutes for them.
City have played twice since Real Madrid last had a game. Is that a help, or is that going to be a factor at all, do you reckon?
I mean, I wouldn't have thought it was a major factor because that game last night between Getafe and Inter, I mean, I thought Getafe were probably the better team, even though they went out for large parts of that, and they've had a similar, you know, kind of sort of time off as Real Madrid, were exactly the same, and Inter have been playing all the way through. I mean, you know, the fact that City were beaten by Arsenal in that FA Cup semi-final, I think, again, just showed their vulnerabilities. If they maybe concede the first goal, there seems to be a little bit of panic around them if they're controlling games but don't get that first goal. So I wouldn't have thought it would have been a major impact, maybe more for the French teams who have, you know, apart from the odd game, have been off since March. I mean, it could be more important for them. But no, I think Real Madrid should be okay with that.
Lars, a lot of people making City favourites for the whole tournament.
Yeah, which is fair enough. I do wonder. I mean, Jonathan Wilson's point from the other pod about how City have struggled against teams who can kind of play through their press, I thought was very well observed. And I think if you look at the league this season, in games against teams from 7th and up, Man City have played 12 and only won 4 of them, drawn 1 and lost the rest. So they have definitely struggled in the league, certainly, against stronger opponents. And listen, nobody's doubting that this is a City team that has big performances in them, but there is a weakness defensively there. And Real Madrid were just, they were an odd team. They were quite relentless after restart, not always impressing hugely with their sort of free-flowing wild football, but they hardly concede goals. And I don't think this is a done deal at all. I mean, they do have to score twice at the Etihad. It's not an easy thing to do. But City have a collapse in them, as we've seen. They have certain defensive vulnerabilities. I think this is quite an open game. And I think you mentioned the long price on Real Madrid to win the Champions League. It's also about who they'll meet afterwards. I mean, they'll have to get past Bayern and that sort of thing. So they've really had a bad draw in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Now, Juventus play Lyon at the same time. The winners of those two games play each other. Here's a question, Barry, from Hans. We are four friends where one of us is a Juventus fan. We're watching the Champions League on Friday, locked in a cabin. The friend in question is adamant that we watch the old lady. Please explain to him why that is more selfish than Ozil staying at Arsenal for another season.
Well, if they're locked in a cabin and the person who wants to watch Lyon Juventus is a blonde, attractive lady, in every horror film or slasher movie I've ever seen, she will be murdered before kickoff anyway. So The rest of them will be able to watch whatever they want. Although they might want to consider escaping or hiding.
It's true. It is a well-known horror convention that whoever wants to watch you enters when there is a choice, they get offed immediately. And I think there's a moral lesson for everyone.
I mean,
there.
I should have gone to Lars. Is presumably the cabin expert here, Lars.
No. I mean, I guess what you could do is you could start, and then you watch the first sort of 5-10 minutes on Leo Juventus, and you realise it's a bit boring, and then, you know, the weight of opinion will sort of push you over to Man City Real Madrid, which will be a more exciting game, I think.
Leo Juventus could be quite interesting, I think. Juventus are obviously desperate to win the Champions League, haven't won it since 95-96. They closed out the Scudetto in recent weeks, but lost 3 of their last 4 games. Now, admittedly, I know it was a shadow side they put out for their final game. Paulo Dybala is an injury doubt for tonight. And Leon, of course, haven't played really since lockdown because the French league was just curtailed. But they have played a series of friendlies in July. I think they beat Celtic, among others, lost to Rangers. And it could be an interesting game. Funnily enough, Lucas Toussaint, who scored their winner against Juventus in the first leg, is no longer at the club. He's gone to Hertha Berlin, so he won't be featuring. But I would be happy enough to watch either, given the choice. I will watch Real Madrid Man City.
Will you watch it in a cabin?
No.
Okay. Mark, do you give Leon a chance against Juventus?
Yeah, I mean, the 1-0 up, Juventus didn't have a shot on target in that first leg. I know it was some months ago now, but I can't remember the last time Juventus played well. I think you have to go back probably to the Inter game, which was the last one before lockdown for that to happen. They were really poor in the Coppa Italia, eventually lost in the final to Napoli, but, didn't exactly tear it up against Milan's 10 men in the semi-final. They've been beaten by, you know, some pretty average teams like Udinese. They were outplayed by Atalanta in a 2-2 draw where two really soft penalties got them back into it. So they're definitely not playing well, Juventus, and therefore they are probably, you know, more vulnerable than they usually would be. But I think Barry's point there about Lyon and their lack of gains, it could well come back to be a problem for them. They were in the French League Cup final last week. They got that 0-0 draw against Paris over normal time and then lost on penalties. But the PSG team was a little bit odd, I felt, on that occasion as well. So it's a bit difficult to judge against another team that's in a similar sort of rhythm place. But I think it's really interesting how we so often talk about managers and the need to win, and Pochettino being one of those that, you know, oh, he hasn't won anything. Sarri in the last 2 years has won a Europa League and the Serie A title. And yet, I suspect he was happier when he was at Napoli and the team was playing really well. And, they were on the verge of doing something special, even though they didn't get over the line. Because I think the football at Juventus is pretty similar to what was served up at Chelsea, really. And it's not great.
So those two games are on Friday. On Saturday, you mentioned Napoli. They go to Barcelona, drawing 1-1 from the first leg. Bayern Munich hosts Chelsea, Bayern 3-0 up from the first leg. Yeah, Lars, if Chelsea were to get through that game, how big an upset would it be?
Absolutely huge. I think Bayern, I think, are joint favourites to win it alongside City, I believe, and rightly so. They've been absolutely stupendous under Hansi Flick. They've looked like themselves again. He brought back the sort of high press after the sort of slightly cagey stylings of Niko Kovac, and they just look a very, very convincing side who can hurt you in a number of different ways. Robert Lewandowski having arguably his best season of his career, just scoring an absolute ton of goals, and they've done surprisingly well in replacing the sort of creative powers of Robin and Ribery, even though the Sané hasn't arrived yet, of course, but they've found other options in the squad. They've been very, very good by Munich, and messing up a 3-0 lead against Chelsea, it's very hard to imagine. If only for the fact, you know, Chelsea have a lot of capability going forward. And I mean, I guess you can kind of imagine maybe a sort of Bayern having a bit of a meltdown and conceding some goals against Chelsea. You really struggle to imagine Chelsea keeping a clean sheet against them, just because they've got so much going forward. Bayern, if Bayern score once or twice, Chelsea have to score about 17 goals or something. Like it's not good. So with apologies to Lampard, I don't see that happening whatsoever.
Chelsea also missing some key personnel. No Cesar Azpilicueta, no Christian Pulisic. Marcus Alonso suspended, Jorginho suspended, although probably wouldn't have played anyway. I have a feeling. I mean, after last year's madness, yeah. I wouldn't rule anything out, but I think Lewandowski and Gnabry could make hay against them.
I mean, if only to see how Jonathan Wilson would try and spin it as a Lampard failure if Chelsea got through. That's why I'll be rooting for Chelsea. Now, on the subject of Chelsea, Kai Havertz deal isn't done yet, I don't think. Lars, you wanted to revisit what you said about Havertz a week or so ago. I mean obviously I don't think anyone will remember what you said about him last time, but I don't certainly.
But it was the sort of the pod equivalent of when you're playing football and like you're playing a pass and the second it leaves your foot you just feel, oh no, that's not going where I wanted it to go. And I was kind of flippant about, I think I made a really bad joke about how Chelsea should sign some defenders instead. Now listen, it's worth taking a moment to talk about Kai Havertz because he's a really interesting player and he's got such an intriguing skill set. I mean, when you watch him, I'm sure the first thing you'll notice is that he's quite quick for someone who's that tall. You know, he kind of glides past people very easily. He's over 6 foot and kind of goes past people at will. And obviously statistics, you'll see that he scores a lot of goals. He's good at getting into the box and can finish with his feet. He's surprisingly good in the air as well. But there's more to him than that as well. He's got a really good appreciation of space. He's someone who often operates in the sort of space right between the midfield and the back four, where there's often very little space to work with. But he always seems to have a lot of time on his hand on the ball. It's one of those, he's got a couple of yards in his head as well. And it's partially because he reads the game really well and his first touch is absolutely brilliant. He's a really good passer of the ball as well. He's got so much going for him. And we can be flippant and say Chelsea probably should sign some defenders, they should, but this is an odd transfer window and this is a player I think probably would have been beyond Chelsea in a normal transfer window. I think there are bigger dogs in European football who probably would have been in for him, but it's slightly odd that, you know, neither Barcelona nor Real Madrid seem to have any money to spend this summer and everything's a little bit sideways. And if Chelsea have a chance to bring him to the club, they absolutely should take that, even at the expense of signing a new defender, because he looks absolutely phenomenal and someone who's a sort of potential, absolutely, you know, to top four or five player in the world, really. He's absolutely extraordinary.
Obviously, people will be able to run the rule over Mr. Havertz when he lines up against Rangers today, Thursday.
Absolutely, yes. And I feel, Lars, you have righted the Lars Siverson Kai Havertz wrong take that no one knew existed until now. Can we move on to Barcelona?
He's a really good player. He's a really enjoyable player to watch. He deserves some love on
okay,
the pod.
Okay, good. Barcelona Napoli, Mark. How do you see it going? 1-1 from the first leg.
Barcelona are obviously favourites, but they're missing players as well, with Busquets and Vidal suspended. There had been a doubt over Griezmann as well, and they haven't got the biggest squad anyway, really. Barcelona got a very strong home record in the Champions League, and I feel like their crowd, probably one of the most influential sort of crowds in sort of Europe, the way that the referees seem to crumble and give them decisions that maybe they shouldn't be doing. You can go right back to when Van Persie was sent off for not very much. I remember many years ago, you've had Motta was sent off, Terry was sent off. So I think this is one of those instances, actually, where the lack of a crowd will, I think, harm Barcelona, just in the fact that it won't be able to influence the officials, because they get so many free kicks that I think are debatable and stuff like that. But I still expect them to go through. Napoli have improved under Gattuso. I'm just not sure they're good enough in both boxes to take advantage of Barcelona's weaknesses at the moment.
We'll look back at all those four games on Monday's pod, of course. On Wednesday, Atalanta PSG. On Thursday, RB Leipzig Atletico. And then Friday and Saturday for the other quarterfinals. Give me a winner in one word, please. Barry.
Bayern Munich. That's two words. Sorry.
That's fine. You can have two if the team has two words in it. Lars Siverson.
Atleti, they're on the right side of the draw. there. I think the one-off game suits them. I think I'd love to see Atalanta. It would be great for football, but I think the sort of gnarly, cynical football of Atleti can win the day.
Mark?
Bayern.
Thank you for answering it how I wanted it to be answered, Mark. You are the winner of part one, but everyone returns for more prizes in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the Europa League then last night, Manchester United beat LASK 2-1, go through 7-1 on aggregate. Can we just talk for a small second about the LASK opening goal by Philipp Wiesinger, which, and I am obviously a purist of the side foot pass, but Mark, this was one of the greatest, this is a great side foot pass. It's a caress of a ball into the top right hand corner, isn't it?
It was, and I'm thankful for Twitter and social media, because it was a game that I had no interest in, didn't watch it, and then last night, just saw this thing of absolute beauty, sort of about 11 o'clock, a joyful moment. It felt not the sort of Yeboah type sort of brilliance of a goal, but a different one. It warmed the heart.
It did, yeah. Lingard got the equaliser. Anthony Martial scored in the 88th minute, only 4 minutes after he was brought on as a sub. United will now play FC Copenhagen in Cologne in the quarterfinals of the final eight tournament on the 10th of August. Lars, you must be over the moon with excitement.
I am. It's very, very exciting. It's Solbakken versus Solskjaer. I mean, bearing in mind that when he was doing his pro license, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer actually visited FC Copenhagen to sort of see how Ståle Solbakken goes about his business and does his job. So it's very much the student returning to haunt the master, I guess, with slightly fancier tools. And it's Ståle Solbakken has done a tremendous job at FC Copenhagen over a number of years. And this was one of their sort of big European nights, I think, beating Başakşehir 3-0. To overturn a one-goal deficit is a huge, huge moment for them. He said afterwards that it was great, but it was only the sad thing was that he couldn't be there with the fans, of course. But it's important as well for Copenhagen. I mean, they've not been as dominant as you'd expect in the league recently, and so getting these wins in Europe is important for them. And coming up against United, yeah, no, it's tremendous. That's the big Norwegian ding-dong. I think a few years ago, there's a really rubbish sort of swords and sandals film called Clash of the Titans, and the tagline was really rubbish. It was Titans Will Clash or something. But this is the Clash of the Norwegians, and I am very excited. We don't see this very often.
The Great Norwegian Ding-Dong sounds like a film you're watching when you don't want your parents to come home. excuse me. Barry, Alexis Sanchez is off to Inter Milan permanently. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer confirmed that on BT last night. That's been an experiment that didn't work. And actually, if you remember how good Sanchez was when he went to Manchester United, we sort of forgotten that he was quite a good footballer before that.
Yeah, it really didn't work out for him there. I mean, I remember he was announced or presented with this ludicrous video with a piano recital accompaniment, and I'd quite like to see him, you know, at the Old Trafford or at Carrington training ground emptying out his locker with, you know, "Hello Darkness, My Old Friend" playing over the background or something, just to have a neat top and tail to his pretty disastrous sojourn at Manchester United. But, you know, sometimes these things don't work out. I think there was talk he might have had issues going on in his private life. You never know, and we often forget that footballers do have stuff going on, other stuff going on off the pitch. It's probably the best solution for Manchester United to take the hit, but it's better than having him sitting there sponging up money like, say, Mesut Ozil is at Arsenal or Gareth Bale is at Real Madrid.
Mark, how's Sanchez done at Inter? Clearly enough to deserve a contract there. Since restart, he's been better, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Conte's been very happy with him. Last night, he fluffed a great chance, a chip that went as far wide as it did high, unfortunately, as he was one-on-one with the goalkeeper late on. I don't feel like he's been as good as what Antonio Conte has said he's been, but I mean, Conte was trying to make a point that he wanted to sign him, and so he was kind of talking him up. He's not at the level that he was at Barcelona and Arsenal, there's no doubt about that. I think he's doing okay, and there's a free transfer. You know, he's going to improve Inter's squad and their options. He can play in a couple of different positions if they want. You know, he could play wide, he can play through the middle, he can play off of the front two. But he's definitely not what he was. I don't know if it's because he's somebody that plays at sort of such a fast pace, and you know, maybe there's just too many miles on the clock. He's not exactly a stroller. Glided through matches previously, and he kind of looks like he's a few years older than he actually is.
Lars, before we go on and talk about the Inter Getafe game, Jadon Sancho, yesterday the Dortmund director Michael Sork said there are no negotiations at all between them and United. I mean, it all sounds a bit odd, doesn't it? I mean, I imagine it'll happen eventually, but it seems like we're hearing a lot of stuff, and it's impossible to know who to believe.
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible that it's true that there's been no contact, and everything that's been sort of reported has been stuff communicated through intermediaries and this sort of thing. It seems a fairly straightforward case of Dortmund having a number that they will sell him for, and Man United being very reluctant to meet that number, and there'll be sort of back and forth shenanigans between now and the end of the window or the deal being done. I find it odd that United have picked this player to discover haggling. Well, I suppose they did try to haggle over Maguire and then ended up spending exactly the number of the money that Leicester wanted to begin with. And I mean, so with someone like Maguire, like, there are other centre-halves out there. And with Wan-Bissaka, like, there are other right-backs out there. But there really isn't anyone like Jadon Sancho. In terms of his output already is absolutely extraordinary. He's very much in the sort of top bracket in Europe of productive attacking players. And he's a 20-year-old Englishman as well. He's a completely unique transfer prospect for a top club like United. It seems like a very odd time for them to start, given their financial resources, to start sort of squabbling over millions here and there, even allowing for the fact that COVID has changed people's outlook on money a little bit. But I think if they think that they can sort of play transfer chicken with Dortmund, and eventually Dortmund will sort of crack, oh God, yeah, please, just take him. We don't, and that's not how it's going to work. Like, they have a very clear idea what they want from him. He doesn't seem like someone who'll throw a sulk and refuse to play if he has to stay there. So I do wonder if this is another one that's going to end with United paying the transfer fee Dortmund wanted all along, just later on in the summer. And I suspect that's what will end up happening.
On the subject of haggling, I was in Marrakesh, where famously you're meant to haggle. And we went into a shop to buy my wife a bag, and she picked up the bag and said, "How much is this bag?" And the man said, $60. And my wife went, "Bargain," which really put us on the back foot. to try and get it down. Okay, we'll pay that then.
What I'm saying is that United should look at Jadon Sancho and just shout bargain and get him in. I mean, it really is. That's what they should be doing. On it, very briefly, I love the notion of a goodbye video. I think this is something that clubs should do more. And MLS actually did it a couple of years ago. They had Nigel de Jong for a brief and unspectacular spell with LA Galaxy, and then he was sort of sent away to play in Turkey instead. And the league itself, not the club, the league, put out a video of his sort of greatest moments in MLS, which was just a series of disgraceful tackles. So it very much looked like a sort of, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. Hope we never see you again type of video. almost even gloating, yeah, the good riddance video released by the league itself. An incredible bit of trolling.
So Inter beat Getafe last night. Lukaku scoring his 30th of the season. Eriksen as well. Getafe missing a penalty with the score at 1-0. You mentioned there, Mark, you thought Getafe were the better side for part or most of that game.
Yeah, that they absolutely were. Handanovic made some very important saves before Lukaku put Inter in front. And then in the second half, I thought Inter managed it better. But still, that the missed penalty from Molina you know, was obviously key in the game, and then Eriksen sort of popped up to finish it off. But Inter were a long way sort of off, I think, their best form. And of course, there's a lot of talk that Conte's unhappy. Not for the first time, he's sort of fallen out with the powers that be.
Well, from Conte, mainly.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Providing the talk.
Yeah, so he's pumped up. The team looked a bit flat and a bit tired. And I thought Getafe were really unlucky. You know, one of the ugliest teams in Europe, I think they've sort of been described as. It was Beauty and the Beast when they knocked Ajax out in one of the previous rounds. But they were on the front foot for most of the game and were just done, really, by, I suppose, the extra quality of Lukaku. But no, Inter need to improve if they're to win it.
We chatted about Copenhagen. Shakhtar Wolfsburg, right? When you look at it and you think 3-0, you think, I might not even click on those highlights to watch that. But Shakhtar 2-1 up going into the second leg. They have a man sent off after 67 minutes. Wolfsburg have a man sent off after 70. It's still 0-0 in the 89th minute, and yet Shakhtar won 3-0. That is brilliant, Lars, isn't it?
Yeah, Wolfsburg kind of dissolved a bit towards the end. I do like games when you get one man sent off on both teams. I think they always end up being tremendous fun, and it raises the question of whether, I mean, this is not a serious suggestion, but I do wonder if, since players are so much fitter now than they were when the rules of the game were devised, and maybe there's a case to be made that you should reduce the number of players on the pitch to 10 each. I mean, maybe that is something they should... It's not something that will get looked at, but it would be interesting because the physical capacity of the players is so much greater now. They can cover so much more ground. And I find whenever I watch a game where both teams are down to 10 men, they're always sort of slightly mad and entertaining.
If there's only 10, can you invert the pyramid?
Jonathan will find a way.
So Wolves play Olympiacos, Leverkusen Rangers, Sevilla, Roma's the a one-off game, isn't it? And FC Basel, Eintracht Frankfurt. Elsewhere, Wolves play Olympiacos tonight, 1-1 after the first leg. For the few people who listened before that game, if that's even possible, I don't know. Lars, do you give Wolves a decent chance of getting through this, and what do you give them a decent chance of winning the tournament?
Yeah, I think it's probably been said a few times. I think the format should suit the way Wolves play. And they should be wary. This is a strong Olympiacos team. I believe they were undefeated in the league until they sewn up the league title. So they even of course, they've won quite a few titles, Olympiacos in Greece. But they do say, the locals, that even by their standards, this is a pretty strong version of the team. And coach Pedro Martins has done a very good job with them, by all accounts. So this is not easy, but the sort of well-organized counter-attacking stylings of Wolves with players in midfield who are very good on the ball. I mean, they should be really suited to this type of thing.
Rangers go to Bayer Leverkusen. They're 3-1 down after the first leg, Barry.
Yeah, it's obviously a very tough assignment for them. And Rangers are this kind of weird situation where they're playing in the present and the past. So their game against Leverkusen was the last game played in Scotland before lockdown. And so, say, Matt Polster or Florian Kimberi featured in that game for Rangers. They're no longer at the club. But Steven Gerrard has brought in 5 new recruits, none of whom are eligible to play in this game tonight. So they're in a kind of weird situation. It's like they're the Flash or something, operating in 2 different timelines. So I hope they don't get too confused. But I know you were on the radio with Ali McCoy this morning. Does he give them a chance?
Well, he said, we need to score the first goal. And I said, I think you need to score the second and the third goal as well. He knows that he wasn't that hopeful, to be honest. But he's got such joy and happiness just surrounding every part of his being that I felt confident after hearing him say, I don't think we've got a chance. But that's probably more about how I feel about my love for Ali McCoist than Rangers' hopes. Sevilla Roma is a one-off game, and Basel play Eintracht Frankfurt 3-0 to Basel after the first leg. That'll do for part two. Part three, Nick Ames will join us, and we'll talk about Arsenal making 55 people redundant. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Arsenal have announced they're proposing 55 staff redundancies as the coronavirus pandemic continues to negatively impact their finances. The club say the cuts are necessary in order to make sure they, quote, operate in a sustainable and responsible way. They've confirmed investment in the first team is a key priority and that a 30-day consultation period will begin to determine the redundancies. A few people have been talking about this on social media. Obviously, David Ornstein from The Athletic saying the players are not happy with 55 staff being made redundant. They agreed a 12.5% wage cut in April after receiving assurances nobody would lose jobs. Yesterday's news left the squad angry. They plan to raise it with the bosses. Ian Wright tweeting, remember who you are, what you are and who you represent. Damien Skirtingboard writes to us, why does Arsenal as an institution always giveth with one hand and then shove a splintered banister pole up my arse with the other? Let's bring in Nick Ames, who had the story in the paper this morning. Nick, how are you doing?
I was good until that visual popped into my head, but yeah.
On the face of it, I mean, the optics of this are so bad that it makes me think it must be justified, otherwise they'd never possibly do it.
I think the timing, given the high of the FA Cup at the weekend especially, and the general wave of optimism that has started to go around their on-pitch operation, I think it has been an absolute punch in the stomach for the people working there, the announcement this week. But the club will justify it, and I mean, I know a lot of companies are going through this at the moment. I know the broader economic climate is not very kind to anyone, but you would have to think there is a better way for Arsenal Football Club to go about this, particularly given the pay cuts to the players, which you mentioned, which were at least partly on the proviso that it was to safeguard the operation around the rest of the club.
I saw Arsblog tweeting, you know, it's important to focus your ire if you're an Arsenal fan at the owners and not at specifically Mesut Ozil, who's paid £350,000 a week. It's very obviously there are lots of businesses, all businesses, where people at the top get paid, paid more than people at the bottom. But football is so skewed that it's almost impossible not to look at how much a player is paid and saying, just don't sign Willian. You know, you'll be okay and you can still keep these people employed, even though Arsenal isn't a charity.
Well, completely. And I think a lot of what has annoyed quite a few people I've spoken to about the statement Arsenal put out yesterday, that it almost justified the decision to make the cuts on the kind of caveat that, okay, at least it means we can make signings. And I think any Arsenal fan or follower with a head on their shoulders would happily write off paying Willian £120,000 a week in order to maintain the integrity of the club, you know. And I don't think you can blame players for this, by the way. You can't blame Mesut Ozil for signing up to the contract that he was offered in the very expensive football market that has existed. You can't blame him for that. You can say, okay, why isn't he playing well? Why isn't he being picked? Should he leave next year? You can do all that, but this has got nothing to do with the players as individuals at all.
I think not only can you not blame Mesut Ozil, and I've seen people try to blame him on social media, he should almost be applauded, because he refused to take a pay cut, and the reason he gave for not taking one is because he wasn't convinced that the money he was being asked to, or the cut he was being asked to take, he wasn't convinced that that money would go towards saving jobs, and he was right. He was absolutely right. It's a terrible look for Arsenal, but Stan Kroenke, Josh Kroenke, they are ruthless businessmen. I've seen people try to justify their decision by saying, well, Arsenal's a big business. Yes, it is a big business, but the reason it's a big business and multi-million pound turnover is because it grew out of this local institution, and it's very important to remember that. It wasn't always a big business.
No. I have the feeling, and it's an opinion, but it's an informed opinion, let's say, that a certain degree of this had been planned anyway and was being railroaded through. And I think COVID is the time that's been chosen to do it. I'm talking specifically maybe about the more high-profile redundancies, which I wrote about last night, and various other people have too, in the scouting department. You might have seen that Francis Cadjigal, who's the kind of de facto head of recruitment, I suppose, you would call him, who's got an incredible track record. I think any club in the world would want him. He discovered Fabregas, Bellerin, Martinelli, players like this. He's worked on most of their top international details in the last 2 decades. He's been let go, and I think that will be confirmed soonish. A number of other scouts have been let go too. And the impression I've got is Arsenal's hierarchy had grown in the last year or so pretty distant from their actual network of scouts and recruitment. And I wonder, and again, let's say this is my opinion, I wonder whether now that is being railroaded through to make a sort of fundamental structural change at the top of a club, or at least to augment it. We have to remember that's maybe not the most important part of the story, because those who are in the recruitment network and scouting and that kind of thing are probably earning more money than your guy in accounts and marketing who are going to be affected by this too. But I think it does speak to a few changes that the club has wanted to make for quite a long time.
Are you talking about Keir Jarabshan here? I've seen his name a lot, and obviously there are clubs who have agents who do a lot of work for them. Sometimes it works really well, sometimes it doesn't. But I don't quite understand what his role is within or without Arsenal. But he also represents quite a lot of players that they have bought or are thinking about buying.
Yeah, he does. And look, I would want to see how all this is going to settle down in the next few weeks, i.e. wherever they appoint new recruitment chiefs, or more likely reshuffle from within. But yeah, I think there is a groundswell of opinion that Arsenal is using a more contacts-led approach to recruitment these days, and maybe they have decided that having this network of people out in the ground, out on the ground, where often agents, by the way, these days are taking on players at the age of looking at players at the age of 7 or 8 and almost becoming scouts anyway. They may have decided that network is simply not worth maintaining. But that will take up a bunch of those redundancies. We know about 3 high profile ones already: Francis Cadjigal, Peter Clark, and Brian McDermott, who some of you might remember from Reading and Leeds. And I mean, the impression I have is that more might be on the way. But I think you have to feel a lot for the office staff at Highbury House who do a quite incredible job, to be honest.
You're absolutely right. And you never take lightly somebody losing their job. There is something quite curious about the fact that on, was it Monday's pod, Barry asked, where is Brian McDermott? And no one had thought of Brian McDermott for about 5 years. Jackpot Kestrel says Barry asked where Brian McDermott was, and a day later he's lost his job at Arsenal. Which other former managers does he want to curse with his newfound powers? I mean, Barry, it's the serious stuff aside, that is quite, it's just bizarre.
It's astonishing. I feel sorry for him, obviously. And if him losing his job wasn't such a terrible thing, it would be just funny. But yeah, it's weird. I mentioned his name, said that I thought he seemed to have disappeared off the face of the earth in 2016, and yeah, a couple of days later he's out of a job. It's, well, at least now we know where he was and that he was working. But I feel slightly guilty, but I hope it wasn't Stan Kroenke wasn't listening to the podcast and sort of went, oh, that name rings a bell. But I'm sure Brian will get a job somewhere else, and I hope his 54 colleagues do as well.
Do you think the owners will be at all surprised by the reaction? Obviously, you know, social media is a place for outbursts that come and then disappear, Nick. But just seeing, you know, Ian Wright talking about it, and perhaps football fans having, and you can't speak for all football fans, but thinking more socially consciously because of the situation we're in at the moment, or is that just as message boards at radio stations I work out, would that just be people yelling snowflake at me? That happened this morning when I mentioned that.
I think there's an extent to which they've been quite insulated from that kind of reaction on the ground, from their perch over in the States. I know Josh Kroenke obviously is a much more visible figure around the club these days, and they have recently appointed a corporate lawyer called Tim Lewis to be their kind of eyes and ears around the hierarchy. And I think he might have sort of in one or two cases read out the Riot Act recently. So I wonder whether some stuff might get fed back to them. you have to wonder whether they care, to be honest. And I'm not necessarily talking about on an emotional level here, but if they made their business decision, maybe they'll decide to stick with it. But I think they have to realise that football clubs are, as other people have said and written already, social institutions, and they mean a lot to people. There's things hit particularly hard in football clubs, and there will be reactions like this, like we've seen on social media. And I wonder whether, given the players may or may not be getting involved a little bit, that might cause a bit of a groundswell for them to scale things back. I mean, it is a 30-day consultation period, which it legally has to be. So I think we have to stress actually that nobody has actually lost their job yet. It could yet be wound back a bit. And I wonder whether it might have some impact, but I've not seen anything from them yet to suggest it will.
Nick, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Max.
Nick Ames there, who covered that story for the paper. Now, VAR, chaps. I know I promised to make the VAR chat stop, and I haven't.
You're failing, Max. You're failing.
Here's a great story. Premier League bosses may stop drawing offside lines on screen next season. The Premier League opted to show the lines being drawn by VAR to offer clarity as to why goals were being ruled offside. 34 goals were ruled out by VAR for offside last season, often by the smallest of margins. And the long-winded process of the lines being drawn out has annoyed all of us, hasn't it? And they see goals ruled out. The rest of Europe's big leagues don't offer the lines to broadcasters and have avoided the same levels of anger when a goal is ruled out. It's a story in the Mirror. I love that idea, is we just put our head in the sands. I mean, what we could do is just not have any of the game on and just be told the score and not know any of the incidents, and then we couldn't be angry about any of it.
But this is a great example of how an attempt at greater transparency has completely backfired, right? Because you're right, other leagues haven't been showing the drawing of the lines. And I think the Premier League, their heart was in the right place. They wanted to show people this is how the process works. But the problem is people don't trust the process, and in a lot of cases don't understand the process. They don't understand that these lines are sort of generated by 3D imaging technology. It's not Chris Kamara with a ruler on a TV screen, because that perspective is a thing that can kind of change how you... Anyway, basically, there are large swathes in the public that clearly can't be trusted with this information because they don't understand what it actually is that's happening. And I'm not saying it's flawless, that the VAR, the sort of minor sort of millimeter offsides annoy me too, but I think they're completely right in saying there would have been less fury if they hadn't shown the drawing of the lines, because it's been misinterpreted so many times.
Are you saying, Lars, you're better than normal people?
No, not at all, but I make an effort to listen to people who are smarter than me who explain to me how it works, which a lot of people haven't done.
Now, Rishi says, you had a lot of, Barry, a lot of praise for your reading of Abide With Me, and you've read things out before, and some people have liked it, some people really haven't, but I just wondered, Barry, if it's made you think about going into the spoken word industry yourself, because it really was beautifully read with a real poignancy.
Well, I am open to offers of lucrative voiceover work if anyone wants to give it to me, or I could do voiceovers on cartoons or animated movies if Pixar want to get in touch. So, yeah, I'm...
Do you want to try a couple?
Well, we had Shake and Vac. That was a famously bad advert. You do the Shake and Vac to get the freshness back. Do the Shake and Vac. But it was basically a housewife dancing around like with the vacuum cleaner, a bit like Freddie Mercury in I Want to Break Free.
Right, okay. I should have probably got some adverts for you to read out, but this is the sort of time when we just go to Mark and say, have you eaten a tangerine recently?
No, I haven't. Not even with butter on that, because I've swerved tangerines.
Have you had any more sweet corn since we last spoke?
No, I've progressed the butter onto Jacob's crackers now, so I'm leaving the sweet corn. So, again, there's not much left now, so I think by sort of mid-August, we're nearly there, aren't we? I think I'll be on a little diet. But there's still some butter in the fridge, so while there's butter and crackers, I'll kick on.
Should be a T-shirt. While there's butter and crackers, I'll kick on. And that is what we'll all do until Monday, when we're back to look at the European football over the weekend. Mark, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lars.
Bye, Max.
Cheers, Barry.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.